Sue, it's my pleasure to introduce the very distinguished participants in our next panel. Excuse me. The topic of the panel is the Northwest Passage, and we're fortunate to have four experts with us to discuss this subject. The first is John Norton Moore from the University of Virginia Law School and the director of the Center for National Security Law and the director of the Center for Oceans Law and Policy. Excuse me, gosh. Professor Moore really puts the moderator of panels in a difficult spot. He has so many distinguished accomplishments, it's very hard to keep an introduction short, and panel moderators are always admonished to keep their introduction short. So I'll just say that especially relevant for the symposium, he served on an interagency task force on the law of the sea, and the ambassador and deputy special representative of the president to the Law of the Sea Conference. There are many other wonderful accomplishments on his CV, which I know all of you have in your materials. And so without further ado, I'll turn it over to Professor Moore.
Dean Stack, Professor Worth, and ladies and gentlemen, congratulations to the Transnational Journal here at Vanderbilt for an absolutely world-class conference. I'm very proud of it, very much in the tradition of this world-class, but a marvelous reputation. I'd like also to join our host at Vanderbilt in welcoming our wonderful Canadian colleagues here. We have a few differences in the United States over the years with our Canadian colleagues in Law of the Sea, but we are extraordinarily blessed with this wonderful democracy we're north. We are so close on so many fundamental issues, and we're also very blessed with the caliber of the international lawyers and Law of the Sea experts from Canada. Now, in recent weeks, we've heard a great deal of controversy and angst about potential conflict in the Arctic, and the arguments that there is simply no law in the Arctic. It's a lawless area in which we desperately need somehow to have some kind of legal framework imposed upon the area. Well, in that connection, I would like to give you a classic story that reminds us of the importance of not overlooking the obvious. And that story, of course, is the famous case of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, who go camping in their tent under the stars one evening. And in the middle of the night, Holmes nudges Watson, wakes him up. A sleepy Watson wakes up, and Holmes says, "Watson, look at all those stars up there. What do you deduce?" And sleepy Watson says, "Well, there are billions of stars up there. There must be thousands of planets or millions of planets. And surely there is life somewhere up there." And Holmes says, "Watson, you idiot, someone stole our tent." Well, hey, the Arctic is an ocean. This is the obvious point, and it is governed by the regime of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. That is one of the most remarkable achievements in international law and international relations in the 20th century. And let me just hit two highlights that relate to this set of issues in the Northwest Passage from the Law of the Sea Convention before we really look in greater detail at the specific debate here. The first point is this is a framework agreement. So it really is dealing with all of these fundamental problems. And yes, of course, around the edges, there are going to be additional kinds of agreements and things that need to be worked out. But the framework is there to negotiate those issues. This is the governing law, an extraordinary governing law, an extraordinary forward-looking governing law to deal with Arctic issues. Just a quick rundown. Problems of fisheries. Fisheries are dealt with in Part 5 on the Economic Zone and the New Straddling Stocks Convention that supplements that. Continental Shelf, we've just been looking at Article 76. The whole Part 6, where Article 76 is located, including setting up this marvelous device of the Continental Shelf Commission. All of that is contained and dealt with in the applicable Law of the Sea Treaty. In addition to that, the environment, we have an extraordinary part 12 of the convention dealing with a whole set of environmental issues, with a great deal of flexibility to deal with virtually every problem I've heard raised in relation to the environment. Now, let me just give you one example. If we needed some greater regulations, for example, internationally, on the kinds of drilling and continental margin development for oil and gas, the framework is all there in Article 208 of the convention. That assumes that we are going to, at some point, work on international agreements that will deal with appropriate international standards that will be binding all states under Article 208 once they are agreed in an appropriate international conference. Same thing is true, by the way, of land-based sources of pollution of the marine environment. Very important. We need to move forward and to work on that agreement internationally. But the framework is there. It's the Law of the Sea Convention. In relation to any special areas dealing with navigation, the framework is there in Article 211, subparagraph 6, on special areas, in which you go to the International Maritime Organization to make sure there is an appropriate taking into account of all of the interests of non-coastal states in the protection of navigational freedom. That was not something that was kind of an afterthought. This is something that was a very important integral part of the framework agreement of the Law of the Sea. So the first point really is that this is the law that's governing the area. I think it has been very clear recently in response to a lot of this, I think, ignorance about an absence of law in the area, that the European Union, the Arctic states, and others have all endorsed and made very clear that the Law of the Sea Convention is the governing, starting framework agreement in relation to this area. Now, the second general point I would like to present to you is that the Law of the Sea Convention did something extraordinarily important in human history in relation to the rule of law in the world's oceans. And that is, we've had for over 300 years a battle, starting with the so-called Battle of the Books, which was not a battle, of course, because there were 30 years between them, of Hugo Grotius and John Selden writing back in the 17th century. And the problem was that it made sense to extend jurisdiction, coastal state jurisdiction, over fish stocks to resolve the common pool problem and to give you a common management regime over coastal fish stocks. On the other hand, it made sense, as Hugo Grotius wrote, to protect navigational freedom. There were a variety of fundamental problems if you were going to turn navigational issues over to the coastal states. And so instead of this 300-year struggle for a single line in the world's oceans that were going to do both of those issues, and they couldn't do both of those issues well, the 82 Convention fundamentally has a functional division of ocean space in which we are extending coastal state resource jurisdiction. The oil and gas of the continental margins is placed under coastal state control, and the fishery stocks of coastal stocks of fish are placed under coastal state control. But at the same time, we fully protect navigational freedom, particularly in the choke points that go from ocean to ocean. Part 3 on straits used for international navigation, strongly in the interest of the international community. But more than that, we have also understood that you can't just, in this extended 200-mile economic zone, let coastal states set ship construction and operation standards. Why not? Because you would have a multiplicity of standards for ship construction and operation. You can't manufacture and put together ships to a multiplicity of construction standards, etc. So you can't basically have coastal state control, which, by the way, can even change through time. It would be like putting a house in the United States on a railroad flat car, sending it to California and then back and asking it to comply with all the building codes en route. In addition to that, something that's counterintuitive here is that a majority of all coastal states, not just landlocked states, majority of all coastal states are totally zone locked. That means they have no access to any ocean on which they face without going through the neighboring 200-mile economic zones of other states. So for states to agree that simply ships going through the economic zone, they were going to let other countries control that shipping, would be effectively to turn them into kind of a landlocked state, losing their sovereignty in terms of access to the world's oceans. Not only that, but frankly, coastal state control and dealing with environmental issues isn't a good way to do that either, because the oceans are all interconnected. And you really need a much more effective international approach to trying to effectively deal with these issues. Now, with that as general background, let's come to the dispute we have had over the years with our good neighbor to the north, Canada, on the caliber of the Northwest Passage and also the recent Strait Baseline system extended by Canada around the islands in 1985. And I'm going to divide this into sort of three periods. The first is to tell you a little bit about some of the origins of this. The second is to tell you about what I had negotiated as our ambassador in the Walton Sea with Canada that I regarded at the time as a solution to the problem. Third is my disappointment when subsequently on the voyage of the Polar Sea in 1985, there was a resurgence of sort of Canadian sovereignty claims. And that sort of phase of what happened after that of drawing these Strait Baseline systems. And then I'd like to come back and suggest a way forward in resolving this, because I think we will resolve this with our Canadian neighbors. But I do think the resolution will be far more than our Canadian neighbors, because the world is now seeing, as we begin to understand global warming, that this is truly a global issue in protecting navigational freedom, as it is in every other ocean in the world. And so all of the other states, not just the eight interested in the Arctic or the five particular coastal states in the Arctic, are going to be involved, and I think ultimately it will be worked out with a special area regime in the International Maritime Organization internationally, of which, of course, is precisely part of the existing framework in the world of the sea. Okay, what was the starting point of this dispute? And there was a little bit going from the back. You can talk about vague claims being made about sector principles to draw sector boundaries up to the up to the North Pole. But Canada never really made any such claim officially. There were some members of Parliament that played with this. There were some in the Soviet Union that played with this idea. But the starting point really is the voyage of the steamship Manhattan in 1969. After oil is discovered on the North Slope, we're looking for a way to bring that oil down to where it's going to be needed. And so initially we look at doing that with new supertankers that would be specially reinforced and go through the Arctic. So as the Manhattan goes in a successful voyage through the Arctic, by the way, through the Northwest Passage, at that point, with Canadian observers on board, even partially flying the Canadian flag at that point, so you wonder why this is going to create some huge problem. But this creates a huge problem politically in Canada. Suddenly there are claims to do, quote, do something, etc. And I can understand a little bit the environmental concern. This would be oil moving, a lot of oil moving through a very sensitive ecological, environmentally sensitive area. The reaction was to pass what is clearly an illegal act at the time, the 1970 Canadian Arctic Water Pollution Prevention Act. Basically a 100-mile extension into this area of saying that the coastal state would control the shipping in that area. It would control being able to set standard ship construction and operation standards in that area. The United States protested. Canada at that point courageously withdrew its jurisdiction with the acceptance of the International Court of Justice jurisdiction. A wise move on your part, I might add, at that point. And then the next thing that happened, of course, is we're all in the law and sea negotiation together. Now, we've been terribly close in working together back in 1960. In fact, it was a joint U.S.-Canadian proposal that had been kind of the key effort we were trying to move forward back in 1960. But at UNCLOS 3, because of this Northwest Passage problem, we were on different sides. And at that point, we kind of had two major issues. One, Canada was trying to push to have the economic zone also turned into an area that they could regulate ship construction and operations. And secondly, we had a difference on the nature of the Northwest Passage. We said that this was a strait used for international navigation. Canada said it was not a strait used for international navigation. Their argument was that a strait used for international navigation under international law really means that it sort of historically has been used as a strait for international navigation. The United States argued primarily that it's a matter of whether it was capable of being used as a geographic standard, but we also argued in the alternative that it had been used. In fact, the number of transits through the Northwest Passage today is at least 69, not counting submarines, etc., and it's well over 100 in the real world. And that's at least 18 different countries that have gone through there. So even under the Canadian standard, I believe they're absolutely wrong in their characterization of the nature of the Northwest Passage. So we had these differences. Canada's awfully good in international negotiations. And we were having problems on both of these points, though when the world suddenly discovered about the zone lock concept, that largely won the issue with respect to the problem of claiming control over ships in the economic zone. Because all of a sudden, the majority of the world community was never going to agree to that. But we still had a problem on straits. So as the head of the Law of the Sea Office in the State Department, I'm going to try to resolve it. And pushed very hard in the NSC system to get a special resolution for Canada in dealing with this. And I've carried the scars around ever since. I finally got that. But it was a tough fight within our government. Took it to Canada. We agreed basically on the outlines of what this was, and I thought it solved the whole issue. Remember what Canada already had. They had control of the fish. They had control of the oil and gas. They already had basically the same scientific research control that you'd have in any other EEC around the world. So the only thing they really didn't have that amounted to anything was this question of setting ship construction and operation standards. So we worked out a special deal. The special deal was in Article 234, ice-covered areas. A special article just for Canada, basically, and, of course, also fits the Russian Straits, etc., in the Arctic. And it gave them, I won't read this, but it gave them basically the ability, in those ice-covered areas, as long as they were ice-covering such areas for most of the year and creating obstructions or exceptional hazards to navigation, they could set ship construction and operation standards for commercial vessels going through that area. This was subject to three understandings. Number one, it had to be done reasonably, a balance in protecting navigation. So it says due regard, having due regard to navigation and protection and preservation of the marine environment. So a balance of protecting those interests. Secondly, it did not apply to vessels entitled to sovereign immunity, that is warships particularly, or Coast Guard vessels, did not apply to them at all. And third, the balance was subject to dispute settlement under Article 297 of the Convention. So if we felt that the balance was really way out of whack, one would be able to go to dispute settlement under 297. Now, the thing that particularly troubled me after this, after having negotiated this, carrying around the scars permanently for the rest of my life of putting this through the United States government. Then all of a sudden I began getting, in 1985, after I'd left the government, calls from the press in Canada saying, well, there's this American icebreaker that's just gone through there, the Polar Sea, and this has invaded our sovereignty. And I said, wait a minute, this is an ocean. You know, this is not an area of Canadian sovereignty. And in addition to that, we've solved this thing. We gave them everything they needed. The only thing they don't have is really claiming the right to control warships going through there. A little overflight issue perhaps too, but don't need that as well. This question of the controlling warships, you don't even have the ability to do that in your own territorial sea. So what is Canada really worrying about? By the way, these are really American warships and submarines, etc., and some Soviet have been Russian after that, been going through there for years and years and years. So this is really kind of a sovereignty issue. So I was very troubled about that. The result is that Canada went forward and put straight baseline systems around the outermost islands. It is an illegal straight baseline claim, I'm very sorry to say. It is not legal under historic waters. It is not legal under straight baseline systems. It is not legal under the archipelagic provisions of the convention. It is not legal as a historic claim, which I gather is the actual claim that Canada is legally making in relation to it. But above all, what it is really an illegal claim to create a coastal archipelago to a continental state, which was rejected by the Law of the Sea Convention. All you have to do is look at the inconsistency here with Articles 45, 46, and then the absence of the regimes that go through the strait. Now, how can we resolve all this? Simple. There will be special needs. The environmental issues are serious for navigation. The safety issues are serious. There will be others. The answer is simply, we will all go to IMO, work out the special regime for the Arctic that everyone agrees, precisely as is the arrangement. What's the residual problem in Canada now with all this? It's a sovereignty claim. It's really what's going on. Now, I would like to suggest, as one who is familiar with a problem in the United States, that I'm going to compare the problem in the United States in getting our Law of the Sea Convention adhered to with the problem in Canada on this. Because sadly, in the United States, we have a group in the hard right that I call the neo-know-nothing faction. They've been out there working very hard to prevent United States acceptance of the Law of the Sea Treaty. Frankly, this group is beyond belief. What is their core argument? Sovereignty. There is not an ounce of sovereignty of the United States lost in the Law of the Sea Convention. There is a massive expansion of resource jurisdiction that gives us the greatest expansion of resource jurisdiction in the history of the United States, greater than the Louisiana Purchase, greater than the acquisition of Alaska, both combined, an area larger than the continental United States of America. This is a removal of sovereignty of the United States. Well, what's the parallel in Canada? The parallel in Canada is their group, and I won't use a name here, that's for them to determine, but it seems to me it's something of the same thing, a group sort of yelling sovereignty here, as though somehow Canada uniquely has a right to claim an ocean. This is an ocean like every other ocean. The Law of the Sea controls it. I am very pleased that I am confident that we are going to move forward to resolve this. The great leadership of people such as Hans Corell and others, this is going to be resolved. And I think in the end, the solution will simply be IMO, though around the periphery, maybe there'll be a few other environmental agreements, et cetera, that'll be worked out. But anyway, thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much for those wonderful remarks. And I note that the Canadians are last on the panel.
No, I think our second is Suzanne.
My order is wrong. I had Commander Kraska next, but excellent. Then our Canadians are not last on the panel. That's outstanding. So wonderful. Our second panelist is Suzanne Lalonde. She's a professor at the University of Montreal. Her research focuses on issues relating to state territory and boundaries, including state sovereignty, the right to territorial integrity, the right of self-determination, and the determination of boundaries. Fantastic qualifications to speak on this panel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I must say it's an honor to be asked to participate in the discussion with such a group of renowned experts. And I noticed that on the flyer I had, I was the only one that was just University of Montreal with no title, and then my biography was three lines. So I just thought, wow, okay. So thank you for allowing me to contribute to this discussion. I would like to thank the organizers for this invitation, and particularly to thank Peter Marshall. Vanderbilt is really spoiling us for other conferences, and especially Mr. Marshall for your patience with respect to myself anyways. And I'd also like to thank Rachel Drade for her welcome at the airport last evening. It was very much appreciated. Well, 15 to 20 minutes isn't much time to tackle such a fascinating problem as the Northwest Passage, and I actually wanted to do what I'd been asked to do. And so I thought, I can't possibly do justice to the legal arguments that have been invoked and relied upon by the various parties in the debate over the legal status of the Northwest Passage. But after this tremendous presentation by Professor Moore, I feel like shouting, no fair! I would have, to give you a mild idea, as I was scribbling down, I don't agree that there's actual use in the Northwest Passage because it has to be international commercial navigation as of right, and Canada's been involved in all the passages, the transits. I don't agree that our baseline system is illegal, and in fact, I would love to have the time to go into the argument. So all I will say is that I hope there are questions and discussions in the discussion period in which I can put that case forward, and I'm pretty sure that Professor de Metral will have some very good insights on these arguments. I had decided with you to perhaps be more controversial, could it be? But to tackle just two larger questions which I think are critical to the debate over the status of the Northwest Passage rather than delve into the Canadian legal arguments. And this PowerPoint is practically not a PowerPoint. It was just a few tools, hopefully. Before turning to my two critical points, I'd just like to underline two smaller aspects which I think have to be kept in mind. First of all, as has been mentioned, the Northwest Passage routes, because there are actually seven various routes, Donna Farin was the one who described them, all of the Northwest Passage routes, of course, are within Canada's exclusive economic zone, as has been mentioned, over which Canada exercises absolute control over the resources in the water column, the marine seabed, and the subsoil. So the Northwest Passage, and these are the more traditional routes, the Northwest Passage is actually much more of a, it is only a debate about the right to navigate and also to fly over those waters. I think this sometimes, anyways, in the Canadian media, that's there's some scaremongering going on about, people are going to come in and grab our resources. The second point, I think, is that at the moment, the debate is cast as a conflict between only two possible navigational regimes, and if you'll forgive the expression, the two possibilities are poles apart. There's the Canadian position, there's the Canadian position that the waters within the Canadian Arctic archipelago, of course, are Canadian historic internal waters over which Canada exercises a full and exclusive control. Internal waters are assimilated to land territory, if you will, under international law. Canada has as much authority over its internal waters as it does over downtown Toronto. Then, of course, as the American position, probably shared by the European Union and others, a mere handful, I would hope, that irrespective, and there's this debate about Canada's baseline system, but even leaving aside the status of the waters in the archipelago in general, there is an international strait, or if you will, an international highway that cuts through the Arctic archipelago, which brings with it an unfettered right of transit for ships of all countries, whether privately or state-owned, a right of transit for submarines submerged, and of course a right of overflight for the aircraft of all nations in the air corridor above the Northwest Passage. What's often used as a metaphor is to say that Canada may own those waters, and even that is not always conceded. But like a British land estate, there is a right for ramblers to cross, to go across that estate. But recently in Canada, we've preferred the metaphor, well, it's our house, and you're saying we're going to have to let anyone come in through the front door and exit the back door with their muddy shoes, even if we're watching TV. So I think these two points are important, and I think maybe, you know, there's some thought, and I think Professor Moore was reaching to that. Perhaps we might be able to craft a solution without an outright winner, an outright loser. Perhaps using less touchy language, we could envisage a right of passage with perhaps special policing powers conferred on Canada as a coastal state. But I would submit we're a long way off in reaching this kind of an agreement. So, to my two larger questions. Is the Northwest Passage a bilateral issue? Should it be resolved bilaterally? Is Canada's only hope to get Washington on board? Canadians, politicians, academics, ordinary citizens, have seemed slightly obsessed with what the U.S. thinks on this question. We so desperately want Washington to agree with us. But of course, every time we ask, and we've been asking for decades, the answer is always no. I actually have come to believe, over the course of my research, that actually I do firmly believe, I am convinced, that Canada and the United States are allies in the quest for a practical and responsible navigational regime in the Arctic. Unfortunately, the U.S. in Canada is often cast as our principal detractor. And there are elements, if not properly understood and explained in their context, which could lend support to that characterization. We heard about the Manhattan Expedition, but of course, the officials at that time had projected that the Manhattan would stay in the high seas corridor, which existed at that time in the Northwest Passage, and therefore did not feel, and absolutely correctly, the need to ask for permission. Unfortunately, the Manhattan got blocked in the McClure Strait and then had to veer south into Canadian territorial waters. And Professor Moore was absolutely right that there was lots of collaboration about the Manhattan expedition with Captain Pullen, the Canadian, on board the Manhattan, and the Sir John A. Macdonnell, Canadian icebreaker, which accompanied the Manhattan, freed the Manhattan 12 times on its mission. So, yes, a successful transit, but, you know, lots of kind of sticky situations. And the other incident that was mentioned was the Polar Sea. And unfortunately, these were blown up by the media in Canada. And the Polar Sea, thanks to work like Rob Hubert in Canada, Ted McDormand, documented the exchange of diplomatic notes prior to the Polar Sea's transit. And there was diplomatically an agreement to disagree, and again, two Canadian Coast Guards on board the Polar Sea as it transited. And I think these illustrate how the two continental partners have collaborated in the Arctic and have found ways to set aside their legal differences to make things happen, to move forward. And one of the key aspects of this long-standing cooperation is the 1988 Cooperation Agreement on Icebreakers, where the two parties agreed to disagree and then proceeded to set out a regime governing transits by American icebreakers engaged in research. And the agreement has held and has been a tremendous success. And a recent meeting of Canadian and American experts in Ottawa in February of last year again showed how it is possible for the two countries to work together and achieve their own objectives without losing political face and without sacrificing the interests of the North. I remember back in 2004, a leading law of the sea expert in Canada, who'd also done a stint at Foreign Affairs, telling me, don't mess with the system, young one, or at least younger one. Yes, the legal issues remained unresolved, but we can work with our neighbors. We make things happen. We get things done. The situation of deliberate legal ambiguity has served and continues to serve both countries well. My response then and my response today is that, unfortunately, it's a new and powerful phenomenon over which neither Canada or the United States has complete control, which is, again, another expression, rocking the boat. Of course, climate change and the melting ice it has triggered at a rate which is exceeding even the most pessimistic forecast has completely changed the nature of the problem. This is no longer a bilateral issue, if it ever was. Canada and the U.S. have had the luxury for decades to agree to disagree, to create specific ad hoc arrangements to deal with specific and limited issues, because until fairly recently, the Canadian Arctic archipelago, frozen, inaccessible, was of little interest to anyone else. The ice has been our ally, but it is disappearing. We have gone from this, which is the Manhattan crossing, with the John A. MacDonald in the background, to this. This is Bellot Strait at the very end of October, October 27th, 2006. There was no ice in sight, and we were the first ship ever to have transited Bellot Strait at that late time in the year. Meanwhile, countries such as Japan, China, South Korea are investing in the construction of ice-strengthened ships. I do believe the ships will come, maybe not, you know, like the Mediterranean, but and I know that scientists disagree as to the precise timing, but all models seem to confirm that in the near or medium term, or longer medium term, shipping will be possible in the Arctic archipelago, at least for some part of the year. And informal agreements to disagree between Canada and the U.S. will not afford Canadian officials the legal authority to act vis-a-vis third parties, which may pose a risk. I've actually found there to be quite a lot of sympathy for the Canadian position in Washington, in academic circles, even in the Pentagon, during the American Society of International Law meeting in Washington last year. A Pentagon official was saying that he wasn't too keen on this question of an air corridor across the top of the continent. But of course, the U.S. has very little room to maneuver, as we've heard. It has been a cornerstone of American foreign policy to insist on the concept of freedom of seas to guarantee the mobility of American naval assets around the world. There is a real fear, and it's understandable, that giving in to Canada, would set a bad precedent for the Torres Strait, the Malacca Straits, and might expose American vessels, as we heard, to an ever-changing and arbitrary rules and regulations. And this is the principal reason why Washington keeps saying no, most recently in former President Bush's Arctic Directive. But in fact, while Washington forcefully rejects Canada's position politically, diplomatically, in fact, it has done very little in, on, or under the water to undermine the Canadian position. And I believe this is a small acknowledgement, tacit, unofficial, but nevertheless an acknowledgement that the Canadian position does bring certain advantages to the U.S. For this reason, I think Canada needs to adopt a two-track strategy. Canada and the United States continue on. Find ways to set their legal differences aside and work collaboratively. But at the same time, I would submit that Canada must continue to assert its claim to jurisdiction over those waters. And this policy should come as no surprise. Certainly, it should not be considered as provocation by our great neighbor to the south. It is a necessary strategy aimed at a wider audience. However, Canada must do better. It needs to stop talking about Arctic sovereignty, something that has come to mean all things to all men, and start acting as a responsible sovereign. Without fanfare or flag waving, Canada must live up to its obligations towards its vulnerable population in the archipelago. For instance, by living up to its obligations under the 1993 Nunavut Lands Claims Agreement, it must respond to the very real needs of a community under stress. It is essential not to lose sight of the fact that despite dramatic images of shrinking ice and stranded polar bears, the crisis in the Arctic is very much a human crisis, which brings me to my second and last key point. One of the criticisms often leveled at Canada, and you heard it this morning, is that we're being greedy. If this policy is not nationalism masquerading as environmental concern or concern for Inuit or Indigenous populations, well, Canada, according to this argument, has all the legal tools it needs to defend its legitimate interests. Just before I continue, I would say that with the... I can't see that. Oh, thank you. I would say that the government of Nunavut's position, and Nunavut is the territory that covers most of the Arctic archipelago in Canada, has described the internationalization of the passage as a catastrophe for the Inuit. But back to the argument. This argument that Canada is being greedy centers around some certain key instruments, and even articles. reference, as was made, is often made to Canada's 1970 Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act. As we heard, enacted in 1970, recently, it was originally a 100-mile zone, recently extended to 200 nautical miles, in which stringent Canadian environmental regulations are applied. The international community, it is pointed out, generously, very generously, responded to Canada's concerns and actually validated the Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act with Article 234 and INCLOS. With this article. Am I doing that? I'm so sorry. A couple of problems, and I feel quite cheeky bringing them up, given that, you know, so many people went through so much to give us this wonderful article. As was pointed out by Professor Moore, and understandably, but still, it's a question, Article 234 doesn't cover navigation by sovereign immune vessels, submarines, and naval vessels, etc., which, of course, can pose a problem, as some nuclear accidents have shown. I think maybe to be on safer ground, let me just second problem. Article 234 talks about the fact that the coastal state in these circumstances will be able to adopt non-discriminatory laws and regulations to control marine pollution from vessels. And I've had this argument with, this discussion with Professor Moore, Professor Oxman down in Miami. You know, Canada was given the right to, you know, it's very wide, but we're left with an actual text where I would submit the words are actually quite restrictive. I don't think it's clear yet how that clause will be interpreted. And given the interests at stake, I think there's every probability that it will be considered narrow in scope in terms of what the coastal state in these circumstances can do. And of course, finally, Article 234 says nothing about the right of overflight in the air corridor. A typical response, and I'm almost finished, a typical response is then to say, well, international instruments should deal with these remaining problems. I don't think that can be me, because I turned mine off. I don't know. I'll just take this off. Okay. Reference is then often made to the polar guidelines, okay, developed under the auspices of the International Maritime Organization, or the IMO. The IMO is the appropriate forum, is the oft-repeated cry. But actually, the history of the polar guidelines, I would submit, rather reinforces Canada's claim to national jurisdiction. Canadian Transport Ministry officials, in conjunction with American Coast Guard personnel and other interested parties, including officials from, including IMO representatives, spent nine years negotiating what was supposed to be the Polar Code, a legally binding instrument with vessel specifications for anyone wanting to navigate in Arctic waters. But at the last hour, other levels of government, including the U.S. State Department, decided to downgrade the Polar Code to polar guidelines. I think we have the polar guidelines highlight a very real problem with international lawmaking, the amount of time it takes to reach agreement. But here in the Arctic, the clock is ticking. And I think also it's all very well to say there's much support for the guidelines, including in the insurance, maritime insurance industry. The fact remains that in case of non-compliance by a ship that poses a risk, guidelines don't give us the authority to act. And I would actually say, even if the Polar Code had been adopted as a legally binding instrument, the problem of enforcement would remain. At the international level, all international lawyers must agree, it's not only the problem of developing strong international mechanisms, it's making sure they're respected afterwards. And, you know, there's always people who criticize me for this, but I'll say it anyways in 2 seconds. I highlight that 2006 WWF report on high seas fish stocks. You'll say, this is apple and oranges, Suzanne, it's not fair. But I just want to say, here where we have a strong convention that actually provided for regional enforcement mechanism. And what do you conclude in 2006? The fish stocks in the high seas are on the point of extinction. These regional enforcement mechanisms have been powerless to prevent violations of the convention. Now, on the high seas outside national jurisdiction, the international community had no choice. It had no choice but to hope that a truly international response would work to a truly international problem. But with the Northwest Passage, there is a choice. The strongest juridical regime that can apply to those waters is undoubtedly the Canadian legal regime. And since the early 1970s, Canada has acted with transparency in setting up its Arctic navigational regime. Professor de Metral was telling me just yesterday that Canada held off adopting its regulations until it had consulted widely with the maritime industry, insurance maritime industry. The regulations have since been updated with input from the IMO. We were the driving force behind the Polar Code to try and have our regulations reflected in it. And those regulations that are now pretty much in the guidelines have been adopted by the big classification societies. And finally, the last thing, we're on record, Canada is on record since at least 1969 as welcoming responsible navigation in the Northwest Passage. My last point, of course Canada must continue to participate in international fora like the IMO and the Arctic Council and must explore all of the existing multilateral regimes which might afford protection to the indigenous peoples of the north, the wildlife, the pristine waters. For example, Ashley Roach was saying, why aren't you looking at special designated areas under MARPOL, under Annex 1 of MARPOL? And I think we have work to do there, but until the very many governance gaps in the existing legal regimes that apply to the Arctic are addressed, Canada must continue to act as a responsible, responsive, and reasonable steward of one of the world's last unspoiled regions, an immense territory of great beauty, but incredible fragility. I believe it is up to the task. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for those remarks. Our next panelist will be James Kraska. Commander Kraska is a professor of international law at the Naval War College, teaching in the areas of international law, law of armed conflict, international humanitarian law, oceans law and policy, and Arctic law and policy. His distinguished service includes acting as the Oceans Policy Advisor for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he represented the armed forces at the National Security Council and the International Maritime Organization. We all look forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much, Ingrid. Well, I'm almost a little tired because you've expended so much energy. I don't know if I have any left, but thank you very much. It's an honor to be here at Vanderbilt Law School, a fantastic law school, and the Journal of Transnational Law, building upon the world-class reputation of Professor Jonathan Charney, who was an iconic figure in international law and is sorely missed even now, years later after he's passed away. It's very interesting. What we'll do is we'll go through the legal analysis, and I think what you'll find when you look at the Northwest Passage is that our most multilateral friend and neighbor to the north is peculiarly unilateral in this particular instance. And if I may borrow Ambassador John Norton Moore's example of the global village, it seems that there's at least one house in the global village that doesn't want any traffic in front of its living room. So taking the benefits of the rule set that everybody else complies with, and yet cutting out or excising exceptions when it comes to areas near its own territory. So the title of this then is Creeping Uniqueness, and that is the sense that normal rules don't apply, that there ought to be an exception or a one-off due to some compelling local circumstance. And the idea, of course, is that the Arctic is a very unique area. It's an exceptional area. In fact, so fragile it reminds me very much of the Philippine Coral Reef, so the Great Barrier Reef off of Australia, or the unique fish stocks in the Baltic, where they have fish, species of fish that are found nowhere else on Earth. Or, of course, the Maldives and the Seychelles in the Indian Ocean, which have unique corals not found anywhere. So you'll quickly understand or get the idea that every meter of the water column has character and often living resources that are unique on the globe. One factor driving our attention toward the Northwest Passage is diminished sea ice. And I think the Lawson Brigham from the first panel is, I would say, without blushing, the world expert on this subject of navigation through ice. But just briefly, if you can see at the top from 1988, the older ice is darker, and older ice is very difficult to cut. And you can see that down at the bottom, there's less older ice, and there's more newer ice, and newer ice is much more easy to cut. And so the bottom line is that you have increased access both in the Northern Sea Route and through the Northwest Passage. This is the finding number 6 of the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment. What this has done is open up additional routes through both of those areas. And this has implications for shipping costs, because it's about a 4,000-mile savings in time between Europe and Asia. That's about 1 week of transit. So you reduce shipping costs in the transcontinental trade. You also reduce environmental air emissions. And if you're not familiar with bunker fuel that goes into diesel fuels on board ships, it's essentially a solid. It's like standing on tar. You can stand on bunker fuel. It's so hard that it has to be heated in order to move through the engines. As a result, it's got a high carbon content, a high carbon footprint, and anything that we can do to reduce or limit the amount of emissions by reducing the amount of time that the vessels are underway is to our advantage. The areas are also being looked at because there is really one world ocean. The area in the Northwest Passage is always being looked at, not just for commercial shipping, but for surface Department of Defense shipping under what we call time-phased force deployment schedules. Because everything that we do, even in this information age, if you look at news clips for the war in Iraq, everything that we do requires large amounts of big, heavy stuff. And we have to get that stuff into theater, and ship is the only way to do it. Some of it is too large to go by aircraft, or you don't have enough aircraft, or the aircraft are much more expensive. So all of the heavy rolling stock that's required to meet our defense commitments in Europe, on the Korean Peninsula, with Japan, with other friends and allies throughout the world, is dependent upon ships, mostly commercial ships, that are bareboat chartered to put the rolling stock on. So in a time-phased force deployment schedule, our opponents know and understand this, and they work in concert to try to game it. So if they know that there's a large force in Iraq that's pinned down, then that means that it will take X amount of time, 2 or 3 weeks, to move that force to whatever crisis happens to be, for example, the Korean Peninsula. So the point is, if you can shave 1 week of time off that time-phased force deployment schedule, it might mean the difference between being able to meet your alliance commitments. So we understand that the rule set that applies in the Northwest Passage and the Arctic Ocean is the Law of the Sea Convention. And this is some progress, because a few academic voices in the United States, as well as some voices, particularly in Canada, had suggested at one time that we ought to create a special deal, a special treaty, a regional agreement, or a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Canada with regard to the status of the Northwest Passage. May of last year, May and June of last year, that issue was resolved at Ililiset when the Arctic countries got together and once and for all agreed that the law of the sea is the appropriate regime that applies in this area. What the law of the sea says is that normally the functional zones that Ambassador Moore mentioned are measured from a normal baseline, and the normal baseline is the low water mark. Everything landward of the baseline is our internal waters, and that's what Canada, at some level at least, likes to claim. And one of the problems as we unpack these issues is that the Canadian arguments in the Northwest Passage in the Arctic Ocean are very much similar to the shifting sands of U.S. rationale in 2003 and 2004 with regard to the invasion of Iraq. In other words, there were a number of interesting and possibly even legitimate theories provided, offered, that would suggest that that war was a lawful war, but the problem is you never could really get your hands around it because it was every week or every month there was a different rationale or a different justification, a different something else offered to see what might gain traction in the international community. Well, that's how it's been with Canada and the Arctic Ocean and the Northwest Passage for about 30 years. So it is somewhat of a high order to try to address all of the kind of moving and shifting rationale in such a short time. But Canada is fairly certain that they want to move beyond normal baselines in their rationale, and that is, in doing so, they have to make a claim based upon either straight baselines or historic waters, encompassing or enclosing the entire area in baselines through historic waters. Well, the requirement for And this is the depiction that you've already seen, where they've drawn straight baselines around the entire North American tip of the continent there. Let's go to historic internal waters first. Historic internal waters, generally everybody agrees, requires adherence to a three-part test. That is that the coastal state has to exercise authority on a continual basis and that there has been a favorable attitude and acquiescence by foreign states. And it's the dean, I would say, of Canadian scholars on this issue, who's looked at it for 50 years, has concluded in an article in Ocean Development International Law in 2007. That's Donat Ferrand, who says that, look, it's really not feasible for Canada to make this claim of historic internal waters. So the next justification would be, let's try to draw straight baselines, let's include this as much like the coast of Norway, where under Article 7, straight baselines may be drawn in localities where the coastline is deeply indented and cut into, or it contains fringing islands. And then there's additional criteria, that is that the straight baselines must not depart to any appreciable extent from the general direction of the coast, and then in addition to that, that the sea areas must be, quote, closely linked with the land. Well, even Donat Ferrand, who recognizes that Canada has considerable difficulty in meeting this test, because the problem is that the coastline of Canada runs east to west, and as you saw in the baselines that I put up, they run in a cone shape, north to south. So Donat Ferrand suggests that there's two ways that Canada might somehow force the round peg of the Canadian geography into the square hole of straight baselines. And that is that that he says you have to appreciate that what really constitutes the coastline of Canada is the outer edge of the islands around which they've drawn the baselines. But that argument really begs the question, because that's what we're trying to figure out, right? What are the lawful baselines? So it's really kind of a non-argument. And he kind of dispenses with it as well, recognizing that it's fairly weak. But what he hangs his hat on, and this is also what Professor Lalonde has adopted. And by the way, I'm honored to have been slammed by you in your article. It's particularly warms my heart, and I very much appreciate the debate. But and that is, if you don't like the shape of the map and the way that it looks on the globe, find somebody who's developed a map that suggests your point. And so this is kind of the best they can do, is this Robinson projection map, in which you can kind of, if you kind of float into it, basically you're more amenable to the fact that there's kind of an east-west sway here rather than a north-south, as if you were looking at a globe. Now let's go on to some other unique areas, just to show you that this is not about picking on Canada. In fact, it's not. I agree with very much, I'm just teasing you, I appreciate it, but I agree very much with you that it's not a bilateral issue. In fact, it's a multilateral issue. The Law of the Sea Convention is the template, I think that we all agree. It's got 156 state parties plus the European Union. And there are other countries, it's only natural. In fact, there are other countries that try to make claims against the international community. And what I would ask you to think of in terms of an analogy, if the village doesn't work for you, think of it in terms of a garden apartment, where the garden apartment is built around a swimming pool and a common area. And you'll have some countries that want to, some apartments that want to project their power, their authority, or claim a little more. I mean, this is the neighbor that parks his, you know, motorcycle right there where the children ordinarily would play and says, nobody else can play on this 3 square meter of common area. We want to take this and appropriate it for our private use and exclude every other actor. Not being a responsible private property owner, saying that I understand that there's this bundle of sticks and that I have to therefore permit or allow this easement by the international community. I don't own this bundle of sticks in its entirety, but it's a functional model, as Ambassador Morris said. So this is an example of the Vietnamese Strait baselines. Here it is clear, in which they claim their own vast internal waters, and then much like Canada, although not nearly as egregious as Canada, but much like Canada, they want to build their strait baseline. This projects about 50 miles out into the water, and then develop a 12 nautical mile territorial sea and a 200 mile exclusive economic zone beyond that. You'll also see that this is near the Straits of Malacca. We had very much the same arguments that Canada is making now in the 1970s, and Malaysia and Indonesia wanted to assert control over the Straits of Malacca, really one of the busiest waterways in the world. About 50,000 ships go through there, and they cited pressing economic concerns. And we might think that, well, there's probably not too much going on environmentally, is what I meant, not too much going on environmentally in the Straits of Malacca, but you'll probably be surprised to know that the waters surrounding the Straits of Malacca have more coral species than anywhere else on Earth, including the Great Barrier Reef off Australia, a very fragile ecosystem. And eventually, Malaysia and Indonesia, working in conjunction with Singapore, were able to recognize the international regime of transit passage through that international strait. And I think that over time, that is where we will end up with Canada. At the International Maritime Organization, accommodating legitimate safety, security, and environmental concerns through a multilateral institution. Just real quickly, this is what a normal baseline in a 12 nautical mile territorial would look like for Vietnam. Burma's got their own line of death. Right here in the Sea of Andaman. Again, it's not nearly as egregious as Canada's, but you get the idea. This is the original line of death, the Gulf of Sidra, which is about 300 nautical miles long, which gives me pause to think that there's probably some mischief for the United States and Mexico in the Gulf of Mexico by way of straight baselines. And since we're not a party to the convention, we've got ample opportunity to do that. These are Iranian black line, quote, black line areas that are also somewhat of a line of death, fortress mentality. And now brings us to the Northwest Passage. Well, you can see in the Northwest Passage that you're talking about not even areas that are entirely overlapped by territorial seas. That is, they're beyond 12 nautical miles with Canadian waters. You've got passages here through the McClure Strait of 98 nautical miles long. So there's really nothing other than just kind of this psychological desire to be able to draw straight baselines. There's no legal justification for it. Now, regardless of whether the waters are internal or not, Part 3 in the Law of the Sea Convention, the regime of transit passage, would apply in this area. And if the regime of transit passage doesn't apply, then no matter what, Article 8.2 would apply. And Article 8.2 says that all states, the international community, not the U.S., it's not a bilateral issue, but the international community has a right of innocent passage in areas that are within straight baselines that have recently been drawn. And the straight baselines were drawn in 1985. Now this is, in closing then, would like to mention a couple of the other arguments with regard to transit passage, because that's really the regime that applies. One of the arguments is, well, there's really no definition for what an international strait is. And if you look here, you can see clearly, if I can go back, I'm unable to go back, so just remember, okay, oh, there we are. You can see clearly that this does meet the criteria for an international strait. That is, it connects the Beaufort Sea with the North Atlantic, the Labrador Sea. Now, there's two pieces to an international strait. There's this geographic test, and then there's also, some would suggest, a functional or use test. And that was the test that was adopted in the Corfu Channel case, which predated the Law of the Sea Convention. I would argue it's been supplanted by the Law of the Sea Convention. Nonetheless, even if you want to use that definition, the Northwest Passage has been fully transited on the surface about 70 times, actually 69 times, by a number of countries. In addition to that, there have been routine and continue to be routine transits through all areas of the Arctic by submarines of the United States, as well as, I imagine, other countries. I know for a fact the United Kingdom and most likely Russia, for about 50 years in the case of the United States, and it still occurs. So there's the use test is met as well. Ultimately, Donat Ferran says that there's three reasons why innocent passage would not apply. And I'll end with this. He says that that the area was enclosed by straight baselines in 1985. Straight baselines, the regime under the 1958 convention that allows straight baselines does not apply to Canada because they were never a party. He says that innocent passage was not part of customary international law by 1985, which I think is just factually incorrect. I mean, this is 3 years after it was reduced to writing in the largest multilateral treaty on the oceans. And then he says that Canada, this is the most interesting, which I would leave with you as students and scholars of international law. He says that Canada did not become a party to the Law of the Sea Convention until 2003. Canada drew their baselines, their straight baselines, their excessive, unlawful baselines in 1985. And therefore, Donat Ferrand would suggest that because the straight baseline lines were drawn before they became a party to the convention, that they're somehow grandfathered in with a wink and a nod, which I think as a student of international law is a somewhat of an interesting legal theory. That is that you get into a negotiation with a quid pro quo and you get the things that are favorable to you, and then when the other party expects you to live up to your obligations, you dodge those obligations by saying, I was doing that before I started talking to you about the agreement that we're in. This really is, think about that in terms of the nuclear arms control context. We know we agreed to reduce in the Moscow Treaty by 2200, but we were building those warheads before we started talking to you. Therefore, our 2200, that was just sort of a theoretical limit, and it doesn't apply in the real world because we've already got those missiles. It doesn't require us to dismantle or change anything. We're not going to accommodate our behavior to the convention. We expect the convention to accommodate itself within our theories. This is ultimately the international law equivalent of jury nullification. I mean, that's what it comes down to. So I think that ultimately the answer to this is going to be found at the International Maritime Organization, which has shown that it can move quickly and effectively. It's got 167 member states. It's a consensus organization, so this is not a politicized organization because it runs by consensus. It's a no-nonsense organization with shipping industry representatives as well as environmental groups. And the last thing I would add is that after 9/11, from 2002 to 2005, in 3 years, the United States and other countries working at the IMO and the international community were able to develop a comprehensive maritime security regime, a binding treaty that includes the most comprehensive boarding regime for weapons of mass destruction and terrorism, and it also can apply in some cases to piracy. If we can do that in 3 years for something as critical as our national security, then I think that Canada would find that organization would be an ideal forum for dealing with the issue of the Northwest Passage. Sorry, I know that was fast. I hope you were all strapped in.
Sometimes when one moderates panels, one has the sense that the panelists are not engaging with each other and simply talking past each other, and there are no real points at which their ideas come into contact. And fortunately, this is not such a panel, so thank you so much for your remarks, Commander Kraska. And I didn't begin by thanking the law students that have put this together, but I would like to do that now. Vanderbilt really does have fantastic students, as several of you have commented, and the symposium is just one testimony to their hard work and intellectual endeavors. So our fourth last panelist is Armand Demetral, who is the Jean Monnet Chair in the Law of International Economic Integration at McGill University. He teaches international law, international trade law, and the law of the European Community, and he has written extensively on these topics as well as others. He has served on the WTO and NAFTA dispute settlement and arbitration tribunals, and is the president of the Canadian Red Cross Society from 1999 to 2001, and as an American, I was particularly struck with the fact that he was made a member of the Order of Canada in December of 2007, which sounds like a fantastic and a high honor. So thank you for coming, and we all look forward to your remarks.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and indeed it's a great honor to share a panel with John Norton Moore, who I think it's fair to say has done more than any other single person to ensure the emergence and the acceptance of the so-called Arctic Exception, or Article 234. I had the privilege, actually, of being in the room when he, on behalf of the American government, told the representative of the Russian government and my own Ambassador Beasley that the U.S. government was prepared to accept the drafting of Article 234, although I know he had certain reservations as to the actual wording at that point. This was a remarkable moment, and I'll come back to Article 234. I'm replacing Michael Byers at rather short notice, so I apologize. I don't have slides, neither interesting, exciting pictures or sad pictures of Inuit on the shore. I hope I'll give you a few ideas. What I would like to say is a few words about Article 234, something about the Straits regime, transit passage. I'll say something about Canada's sovereignty claims, since, you know, this has been raised, also the whole question about where is the best place to have an arrangement, or how do we resolve these things. Now, just a few points. I think, you know, there's obviously a great deal of concern and interest at the implications of the melting of the ice and climate change. My perhaps uninformed feeling is that we still have a certain amount of time. One sees these photos of, you know, the Arctic waters without ice. But I can assure you there's a lot of ice around still, and there's going to be a lot of ice for quite a while yet. I can see ice from my house on the St. Lawrence River, 3,000 miles south of all this, today. Oh, I mean, I'm not there today, obviously, but I did yesterday morning. I could look out, and there, off in the distance, the St. Lawrence River. And only 2 weeks ago, several vessels got blocked in the ice 100 miles north of Quebec City, at a point where the St. Lawrence is 50 miles wide, and the icebreaker that went to get them out got stuck. So 4 months in the year, the St. Lawrence River is an area where ice is a problem, let alone the Arctic. This is not to minimize the issue, but I think one should not perhaps over-dramatize. The second that is related point is, well, how much shipping is there? Because it's clearly an issue. Is this going to be used much more as a strait, and will the problem suddenly accelerate? Well, at this point, virtually no navigation is through the Arctic. And as far as I know, except for military passage over the archipelago, there is some commercial navigation in and out. There are several mines and there are several companies that are now bringing ore in and out in specially designed vessels. But they're not going through, and I gather that that particular company that had a contract where they could have supplied the Thule base from the west coast of U.S. decided and thought they were going to do it last summer, at the last moment didn't, because they were worried about the ice that they'd meet as they went through. So the concern, and this I think when we said to Canadians even more than Americans, the concern that suddenly this is all going to be opened and the whole world is going to be rushing through the Northwest Passage is somewhat overblown at this point. But clearly it's something we have to be facing and thinking about. Now, the other thing is Canadian claims, let it be said, Canada does say this, unlike the American proclamation, the recent proclamation, or directive, excuse me, we do say this is not a strait used for international navigation. And that has been the longstanding position, argued in many ways perhaps, but that has been the position. And at the same time, as the statement by former Prime Minister Trudeau was put up, we have always said we're prepared to facilitate navigation. So that there are the two sides of it. It's not that we're strictly, we're just saying we don't want any part of it. We know we're part of the world. We know that there are advantages of traveling through. If it can be done, we have particular concerns as to particularly environmental concerns, but there are also human concerns. I don't think outside Canada it's appreciated just how much there is an increased awareness of the presence and the place of Aboriginal peoples in our society. And these peoples, for them, water and land and ice, it's the same thing. They live in and on and for the land. And that's a more powerful issue. You may say, well, that's only just 50,000 people. They don't count. They're Aboriginals. They do count. At least they do count in Canada. And I note that they're mentioned in the presidential directive, too. So that's something that one... And the other side is the environmental concern. And I think, you know, push comes to shove, we will not be sacrificed on the altar of U.S. universal concerns. What is specific and what needs to be protected in the Arctic, we don't want an Exxon Valdez in the Arctic, and it's just too easily happening. It could happen just too easily unless we make adequate arrangements. So I think that's, I'm trying to explain where Canadian government is coming from. It may be a little difficult sometimes to pin down where we're coming from, but I think that's as I understand it. I've been following this. I was at one point in my life part of the process of arguing for the Canadian position. I, as the kind of introduction indicated, I spent a lot of my life involved in other things lately, but I'm now coming back to Arctic questions, and I'm currently involved in publication of a very large document dealing with the Canadian historical record of dealings with the Arctic since 1867, and it runs to about 4,000 pages in the rough. So this is a profound issue for Canada. Now, just a few words on Article 234, and here I'm addressing myself as much to Canadians as to Americans, because I believe that we really did, and John, I really believe we went a very, very long way towards solving the questions by drafting Article 234 as we did. From the Canadian perspective, there's an acceptance of the special nature, that it is quite different, and the powers that can be exercised there are clearly way over and above what can be done in other areas in terms of ship design, the construction, manning, all the rest of it. And it seems to me that the answer to most Canadian concerns is that use the powers you have under 234, and we should be able to deal with virtually everything and deal with the perceived threats and the dangers and particularly the environmental threats. Certainly 234 covers, and it was what it was designed to do from our perspective when we negotiated, it covers the Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act and the regulations that have been made over the years. I think it covers the so-called Nord regs and the recent decision to make those obligatory in the sense that it'll now become necessary for ships wanting to go through to notify their intention of doing so. And it seems to me that Article 234 covers all these things, and that these are the essential concerns that we've had, so that I believe that 234, as it was drafted, you've seen it, does cover most Canadian concerns. It could also serve as the basis of cooperation with others, and indeed, as Suzanne pointed out, the original Act, Arctic Waters Pollution Prevention Act, and the regulations made under it, the efforts, the Arctic guidelines or the attempted code, we have in fact not had any real conflict on the technical level as to whether the particular ship standards that have been made over the years are acceptable to and are prudent and are accepted by the international marine insurance industry. And after all, except for military vessels, nobody but someone who's crazy would sail into the Arctic without getting marine insurance. And you don't get marine insurance unless you respect rules which are actually the Canadian rules. But it's partly because the Canadian rules are reflected internationally. As I say, it seems to me that Article 234 and the spirit, the acceptance of the specificity of the Arctic, goes a very, very long way towards meeting Canada's concerns, but also dealing with the environmental problems that exist. Article 234 coexist with the right of transit passage? My answer is yes. If it's going to be pushed? My answer is yes. Well, I'll come to what I think transit passage may involve, but in a moment. But I don't think the two are totally incompatible, although 234 applies over and above the right of transit passage. It does not trump military immunities, but it does trump transit passage. But I don't think the two are incompatible. Now, just a few words, I don't want to go on for too long, a few words about the Straits regime. The regime, essentially the regime of transit, non-suspendable transit passage. Now, in this, I don't think means that any ship, big, small, or whatever it is, nuclear powered, can simply say, we're going through that particular strait, damn the torpedoes, here we come. In most areas, that would lead to collisions almost every day, and the international community has very wisely tried through the IMO to adopt traffic separation schemes and other rules to deal with that. And in fact, that's clearly the obvious and the necessary answer. But I spent a few weeks reading in the Lauterpacht Center this summer, reading articles on international straits and trying to catch up what's happened lately. Well, it does seem to me, with all due respect to those who say, you know, it's non-suspendable innocent passage, non-suspendable transit passage, nothing else. Look at almost every major strait, and there's usually some kind of IMO rule, and it's usually the modus vivendi that's working pretty well. But, I mean, they built a bridge across the Great Belt, a great big hulking bridge. Nobody stopped them. The Australians are doing things in the Torres Strait that I don't know that one would find are totally incompatible, but are they unreasonable? The Strait of Magellan, there have been issues of passage of certain kinds of ships. Try to take a large supertanker through, you know, past Istanbul. Well, the Turkish government stops everything for a four-hour period before and takes the ship through because it's too dangerous to let them go on their own. I don't think that's incompatible with transit passage, but I do think the transit passage, as it is evolving, and I'll just leave it here, I think there is custom that is fleshing out the meaning of transit passage, and a lot of it is through the IMO, but I would suggest that the fact is that where there are particular concerns and special issues that arise, in fact, there is some adaptation, and the coastal state and its concerns and desires are not out of the picture. So if one comes to the Arctic, I would say, or if Canada is in a position of having to defend something very special that it, and unusual that it's doing, it can probably point out that other places in the world, other straits, which are much more clearly used for international navigation, the coastal state is by no means out of the picture. And there is a recognition of the special issues arising there. So I could go on further about that, but I'll just... as to sovereignty, well, I've said something about Inuit, and I think that's a much more powerful issue than people give credit to. The other thing is Jonah Farron, Professor Farron, really is saying the Arctic archipelago is a coastal archipelago. And that argument, I know he does believe in, and I don't think it's so foolish. After all, the water ratio in the Norwegian archipelago that you cited is 3 to 1, 3 water to 1 land. Whereas in the Arctic, it's 0.9 water to 1 land. Not bad for an archipelago. No, that's so. I wouldn't be so, you know, unhappy to if one had to defend that sovereignty argument in the end. But as I say, I think you may say Canada's shifting around, looking for the best argument. Perhaps one does that these things, you know, in life. But It seems to me that the thought that this is a coastal archipelago is not as foolish, not as difficult to defend as some might say, if one is pushed to deal with it on those terms, as perhaps we may at some point, because once the United States ratifies the Law of the Sea Convention, then we're exposed to certainly questions like, will the 234 apply in those months when there is less ice, or in those areas when there is less ice than there used to be? I assume that could be justiciable. And even the issue of, can there be transit passage there? There would be an argument that this goes to that exception of historic title, but I imagine that the transit passage issue could be raised. And so there are many issues that will be justiciable, and I think Canada will have to face that. But I'm not sure that we're in such a bad position. I think perhaps I'm an overly enthusiastic lawyer and ready to get out there and defend my country again, but I would have thought we're not in such bad position on that. Now, finally, is there room for further arrangement with the United States? Well, in fact, we have this notification arrangement. It seems to work pretty well. And I've heard from Americans, and we've even read it, that perhaps there could be further arrangement dealing with continental security. And one, it is pointed out, there is very little legislation in American Arctic waters comparable to Canada's legislation. And we may ask, why not? And if you put together Canadian legislation and American legislation, one could say that would be a responsible thing for the United States to do in an area of high vulnerability. You've already had in the Torrey Canyon, what was it, not Torrey Canyon, the Exxon Valdez was not in the Arctic. It was further south off Alaska. Imagine what might happen when you have big tankers coming north. So perhaps there's an argument for the U.S. combining its own combining legislation similar to the Canadian legislation for vulnerable Arctic waters. I've also heard it said that might assist in protecting American security. If you have something like the Nordregs, both from the east and the west. Although I must say the idea that somebody might drop off a terrorist on Ellesmere Island and that poor terrorist might be a threat to U.S. security has always been one which leaves me a little perplexed. I think the terrorists will end up frozen after about 24 hours, but the security concerns are more serious than that, I guess. But if one wants to cast it in those terms, why isn't the United States working a little more closely with Canada? I think perhaps we got it right first. So I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Armand. And I also wanted to add my thanks for your stepping into this panel at the last minute. Much appreciated. Well, gosh, there's a number of things we could do now. I could ask my questions, which I don't think I'll do, because I guess I'd like to give our panelists maybe if we could limit your rebuttal time to just 1 minute each or 2 minutes to just get out. There were so many points when I saw all of you wanting to debate with each other, and I hate to turn it over to the audience without allowing you at least a little opportunity to engage with each other. But I would like to get to questions from the audience, so if you could stick with your big points, your most important ones, that would be great. So if you'd like to start out.
4 points to be made. That gives me 15 seconds to each point, apparently. The first point is, after this discussion, What really is it that Canada doesn't already have under 234 and the rest of the convention? And the answer that they've given very clearly are simply two things. One, they don't have the ability to control warships going through the area. You don't have that even through the territorial sea. And the idea that the international community is going to give someone else the ability to control warships going through the area is simply a non-starter. It won't happen. The second thing they don't have is the control of overflight rights. I haven't heard that aircraft are the cause of the great pollution problem in the Arctic Ocean at this point. And the idea that you're going to be able to assert control of aircraft overflight between major areas of the high seas, two oceans, and control those oceans is, I think, very counter to the appropriate interest of the international community. Everything else, Armand is absolutely right that 234 is an overlay in straits as well as an overlay in the economic zone. So I think we need to be very clear of the kind of unilateral claim that Canada is making here. Point number two is we also need to recognize what this really is. This is not a lawful claim. This is a politically driven claim by a segment of Canada that is very interested in pushing sovereignty as a fundamental sort of ideological principle. Now, that doesn't mean that we can ignore that. This is something we're going to have to figure out a way to work this thing out with Canada. They're a good neighbor of ours. We need to work it out. We need to work it out, however, in a way that does not harm international law, that does not harm the interest of the international community, and does not harm fundamental principles of oceans law. The simple solution to that is to work through the IMO, and I'm convinced in the end that we'll do that. Point number three has two parts. One, and both of these relate really to the criteria, the issues that Commander Carrasco was discussing. And I think they just show again the bankruptcy of the international legal argument being made. Armand is absolutely right that what's really the nature of the claim here is a coastal archipelagic claim. That means a continental state has the ability to draw lines around offshore islands that are way out, not fringing, and bring them back to the continent. Greece, for example, in drawing straight baselines from continental Greece out to the various islands and bring it together. That was clearly and emphatically rejected at the Law of the Sea Treaty. What's wrong with the coastal archipelago meeting the criteria? It doesn't meet Article 45 because you have to be a mid-ocean island. You cannot be anything other than that. Two, it doesn't meet Article 46 because you have to have the proper land-water ratio. And the 0.9:1 even doesn't fit, even if you're not counting the second largest landmass, I think, of any country in the world in terms of Canada. So even if you're not counting that, it by Armand's figure, doesn't fit within the 1:1, ratio of 46. And most importantly, if it did, you'd have to apply the regime of archipelagic sea lanes passage through there, which gets you right back to the Straits position. The final point really relates to multilateral fairness. One of the arguments that we've heard is there's just a failure of multilateral and the international community to deal with these issues. This is precisely the argument that was presented by Canada and rejected during the 1970s in the negotiation. This was their main argument. We couldn't go to IMO, IMO was a failure, and we had to give this control to the coastal states. It was rejected by the international community at that time, and now it's far clearer that it ought to be rejected. IMO is clearly doing the job. Issues such as the Strait of Malacca, Singapore, that Commander Preskin turned about, and there's no doubt that it can do the job here in relation to mandatory provisions in the end that will emerge on the safety and the environmental issues. I'm quite confident that will come out of IMO in that setting. Now finally, let me also just give you another parallel. This will take 5 seconds on it. The argument that somehow regional fisheries agreement had failed, and that's the failure in terms of destroying fish stocks around the world, is bizarre. What's destroyed fish stocks around the world is, in fact, coastal nations that have been given the authority to do it, and there's a massive government failure, $20 billion in subsidies by states, by individual states. It's the coastal states that are the problem, not the international community at this point.
Thank you. Suzanne? I had the pleasure, I worked on a 93-page paper, The Life's Work of Bonhoeffer on the Arctic. It took me 4 months and I read everything he wrote, including his 1950s PhD doctoral thesis in France. So I feel my first comments have to address certain things. The Robinson projection map was adopted by National Geographic in 1988 as the appropriate worldview map. So it's not some random map to support Canada's position. Two, high seas, territorial sea beyond in the Northwest Passage. Mr. Kraska's map did not show the islands Lother and Young in the main passage, which shrink the extent of the passage to less than 24 nautical miles. The second functional criterion, international use, cannot be asserted clandestinely. Most of the submarines are under under NATO arrangements, NORAD arrangements, and the Russians aren't telling us. Well, that's not the assertion of an as-of-right passage. And thirdly, oh, he would be up waving. Bonhoeffer has never claimed that innocent passage wasn't customary. He claimed that the rule that baselines can't cut off passages that might have had an innocent passage. It was referring to the specific rules in UNCLOS that cuts off it had not a customary basis by 1985, which I believe is right. Bonhoeffer was not saying we should be evaluated by our own arbitrary criteria. When we drew our baselines, we were neither a party to the 1958 or 1982 conventions. Our baseline system should be assessed according to the Norwegian fisheries case, and there is no mention of fringing islands in that fisheries case. The standard is different. And coral reefs, I understand different uniqueness. There are no people on coral reefs. There are Canadian citizens that are going to be impacted by the shipping. And actually, it's not only about whether ballast waters are poured out. The Inuit are worried about noise and what will do to the whales, as we heard about what's happened in Alaska. Overflight, it's about noise as well. And so I think there are, and so I was so happy to hear Professor Alvin and Kata saying, I actually believe, perhaps, I think we can be targeted with the unilateralist, you know. How can you abandon your traditional stance when suddenly you have an interest to defend? That I kind of feel like hiding under the table. But in terms of the legal, to call it a bankrupt case, I think is quite strong language. I think we're better, anyways, I think we're better prepared than that.
Sure, just a couple of points. Canada became a party to the Law of the Sea Convention in 2003. Canada has a legal duty to comply with the terms of the convention, irrespective of any other country does. If the United States never becomes a party, Canada still has an obligation to comply with the provisions of the convention. I think it's evident by the tap dance that we can see in the literature over the last 40 years that that they understand that they're not on. That they don't have a good case. In fact, there's no country on earth except Canada that has accepted any of these rationale. So it's not that it's a few countries, it's that every country who's ever spoken on it, except for Canada, does not accept Canada's claim. I think that ultimately, the Canadian military, ironically, is coming to see that if they expect to play a global role and have a global presence, particularly in their competitive advantage of peacekeeping, that they then have an interest in being able to transit throughout the global ocean. And now they understand this tension with maritime homeland security, this fortress mentality, and freedom of navigation. That's the same tension, by the way, that no coastal state is immune from, including the United States. Because every country seeks to appropriate the rights of the international community and convert it to its own because there's a very low cost in doing so, because you're trampling on the community's rights, and it takes 150 or 200 countries to complain, and you also got kind of a local superiority. Finally, and I'll end on this, that is that this is really not almost not a legal issue anymore. It's really the international equivalent of jury nullification, because in Canada it's an emotional issue. It's what Ken Booth used to describe as a psycho-legal boundary. This is red meat for Canadian voters. That's what it is. It's red meat for Canadian voters, and the media in Canada and the Canadian government are going to have to become responsible and realistic about their duties under the Law of the Sea Convention in order for this to work. And that means going to the International Maritime Organization, like all the other countries, like Australia did with the Great Barrier Reef and the Torres Strait, like the United States did with the Northwest Hawaiian Island, and countless other examples. All of the Straits regimes that Armand mentioned have been validated and approved through the consensus process of the International Maritime Organization, rather than just unilateral one-off instances.
Thanks. Armand?
Oh, well, I'll just be very brief. We
made a deal that involves passage by
sovereign immunity and overflight, and I don't think we're challenging that.
Okay. All right. Oh boy. It's gosh. Okay. I hate to be the one who stands between a bunch of hungry people and lunch.
Former Undersecretary General of the UN.
Yeah.
If you permit me, the question doesn't have to be answered now, but I promise in another constituency to put this question to this body, namely the question of enclosed and semi-enclosed waters, seas. Maybe after the last panel, those who feel competent to respond to this question could do so. Do you consider that the Arctic Ocean would fall under Articles 1, 2, 2, and 1, 2, 3? I have asked the question. I doubt whether this is so, but we could leave that for the later in the autumn. Thank you.
I think that's a great idea. Well, let me take one more question and just the questions, and we can leave them for discussion at lunch, maybe for thinking for the future panel. So one more question, and then we'll head for lunch. Yep.
You posited a friendly amalgamation of Canada and the U.S., with Washington being the capital of that amalgamation. What do you think the policy is?
That's a great question to discuss over lunch. So joining.
Can I answer that briefly?
No. You know what?
I have to tell
you. No, because then I want to thank our panelists and wrap it up.
Actually scrupulously complies with the Law of the Sea Convention. I challenge anybody to find an excessive maritime claim made by the United States.
Great. Joining me in thanking our panelists.